across the top of it, Compassionate Regency. And if you've got your Bibles, you can open them up to Ruth chapter 2. Ruth chapter 2. Ruth is just after Judges, just before the couple of Samuels. And if you don't have a Bible, there's one provided for you in the book rack. If you'd take that out and open it up to Ruth chapter 2, you'll recall, just to give you a little bit of context, just in case you were not here last week, that the events in the story of Ruth occurred during the days when the judges governed. You need just look to the last verse of the previous book of the Bible to see that was a time of open rebelliousness, where everybody did what was right in their own eye. It was probably contemporaneous or at the same time as two of Israel's most famous judges, Gideon and Samson, guys that started off their lives well but did not end so well. And that's typical of the judges. The judges were kind of a cycle of things that started off really well and then ended really badly. And that cycle continues in Israel's history, and they lament that they do not have a king. But of course they did have a king. That king was God. And God shows his goodness right in the middle of this story of the judges. And right before we get to the monarchy and in the Samuels, we have this little story of how good God is when he is allowed to be king of someone's life. Because of a famine in Israel, there is a Jew named Elimelech who migrates with his wife Naomi and their two sons from Bethlehem to the foreign country of Moab. They went over the Red Sea and down into Moab, and Elimelech, while he's there in Moab, unexpectedly dies, leaving Naomi a widow. And almost immediately, her two sons get married, one to a girl named Orpah and one to a girl named Ruth. Sadly, letter C, top of the next page, Naomi's sons also unexpectedly die in Moab, leaving widow Naomi with her two widowed daughters-in-law in the distant land of Moab. Now, the only way that women could have money back in those days was through the efforts of their husbands. It wasn't like the wife went out and got a secretarial job. That wasn't how it worked. You were supported by your husband in this very, very patriarchal society. And so when all the men in the family died, there was no sustenance for the family. No food. Their home was just simply a place to be occupied, but there was nothing coming into it that would help them live. So these ladies are destitute in a foreign country. Naomi, under this pressure, decides to migrate back to Bethlehem from Moab. She's going to go back to Israel, to the town of Bethlehem, from the tribe of Judah, where she is from, where her husband was from. And she's going to migrate back. But she asks Orpah and Ruth to remain. Go back to the families of your husbands. Go back to them. Your life will be better there. God has put his hand against me, Naomi says. He has not put his hand against you. This is not your fault. You need to go back to your families. Orpah agrees. She kisses Naomi on the cheek and she agrees to return to her family. But Ruth, in very eloquent style, expresses to Naomi, I will not leave you. Your God will be my God. Where you go, I will go. And nothing will separate us but death. And so, Naomi, recognizing that Ruth is pretty bought in at this point, does not argue with her. And Naomi and Ruth migrate back to Bethlehem. Understandably, but sadly, of course, as Naomi arrives in Bethlehem, people recognize her because she was part of Elimelech's family. It was an established family of the Ephrathites in Bethlehem. And they recognize her and they say to her, aren't you Naomi? But her bitterness and her sorrow just pour out of her. And you can feel it in the text as you read it. She publicly laments God's treatment of her. She calls out God for really condemning her. How she left full. She left with a husband. She left with two sons. And she has come back empty. The only companion she has in this world is now Ruth, who is a foreigner. The tables have turned for Ruth. Ruth was a local in Moab, a citizen, a resident, and now she is an alien in a foreign country. And her only family, really, is Naomi, who has become like her own mother. But at the very end of chapter 1, there's just a little bit of hope. And it may not sound like hope to you and to me, because we don't come from an agricultural background. But right at the very end of chapter 1, it says they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. Well, in an agricultural kind of setting, and in a place where there was a famine and now there was not, this was great news. This meant that there was hope on the horizon. This was kind of an upswing in the text. I mean, think about what has happened in just one chapter. Naomi has lost her husband. She has lost her sons. She has lost one of her daughters-in-law that goes back, Orpah. She's now with Ruth. They've migrated to Moab and back from Moab. They are devastated. They are empty. They feel that God has abandoned them. Naomi says, don't call me by Naomi anymore. Call me Mara, which means bitter. I am devastated by all of these events, but a little hook right at the end of the chapter. The barley harvest is about to come. And right then we get a little segue in the story. We just get a little aside in chapter 2, verse 1. We get a little bit of biographical information that we need to know for what's about to happen. A little bit of foreshadowing. Immediately after the mention of the impending barley harvest, this is number 2, letter A, we are introduced, as a quick aside to our story, to a family member of Naomi named Boaz, a great man of wealth and of influence. Look at it in chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. It's just a little parenthesis. It's just a little setup so that you know a little bit more about the story that is going to happen. Because it's so extraordinary what's going to happen that you kind of need to know who Boaz is before you get there. The story picks back up, though, in verse 2. And by the way, I give you some geek notes because the significance of a couple of the things in that little verse are pretty important. There are some significant foreshadowing issues that occur in chapter 2, verse 1 about Boaz, about the family that he belongs to, about being a kinsman, and about the kind of man that he is, that he is wealthy, that he is influential, that he is noble, and he is well known as being noble in Bethlehem. And so those things are very important as they set the stage when we get back to the story of Naomi and Ruth in verse 2 of chapter 2. So we return to the story, and again, we find Ruth asking Naomi to go and glean. If you don't know what gleaning is, I've given you a thorough geek note on gleaning, just in case you want to glean, you know, today. From the barley harvest, in order to provide food for her and Naomi, take a look in chapter 2, verse 2. And Ruth the Moabitess, that's going to be emphasized throughout. Ruth's not of Israel. She is a foreigner in a foreign land. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I might find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. We see a bit of the relationship that exists, but we also see that Ruth is taking the initiative. She sees that they are in dire straits. She sees that they have no food. She sees they have no sustenance. She sees that they don't have anything. And she says to Naomi, rather than wait here for someone to help us, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do what the orphans do. I'm going to do what the people that are poor and destitute in this culture do. I'm just going to go out into the fields and I'll follow the harvesters. And when they drop some grain, I'll scoop it up. And I'll put it into my cloak, and I'll hold on to it. And then I'll bring that food, the leftovers of the harvest, I'll bring it home with me. And then that's what will support us. That's what we will eat. It's a statement of real humility. I mean, unlike Naomi, who is understandably paralyzed by her losses. I mean, she's devastated, and she says so. She's bitter, and I think we can understand it. I think we get it. We can understand why she is mourning the loss of the whole of her life. Ruth shows extraordinary compassion, though, through her devotion to Naomi. She makes provision for her by going out and gleaning. She shows tremendous humility. She has come from a family that had everything they needed in Moab. She could have gone back to a family that where she wouldn't have to do this kind of thing. And she takes the role of a destitute person, and she just accepts it. It shows a ton of humility, and she shows courageous risk. She was a woman that was going into the fields. Oftentimes, the gleaners that were in the fields would be people that did not have the highest of morals, and a woman would be taken advantage of either by the workers in the fields or by the other gleaners that were out there. They would just see this undefended woman and they would take advantage of her. It was a dangerous job. And she was a foreigner. On top of not being an Israelite, on top of being a woman, she was from Moab, one of the enemies of Israel. And everybody would have known it. And so she was really taking her life into her own hands. She was risking tremendously life and limb. It would have been no big deal in this culture and in this society for her to be just dragged off and raped. It was a dangerous situation that she was stepping into. She shows devotion, she shows humility, and she shows courage. I'll get to what all of that means in just a moment. But it's not a mistake that Ruth is presented immediately after Elimelech is presented as a man of great wealth and influence, a man of nobility and character. It's not surprising that we see Ruth presented in the same manner. What we have are two people that are on different tracks in life that don't know each other, but they're moving along at the same pace. And so we come to verse 3. So she departed. Ruth went and gleaned grain, letter D, in the fields, and eventually ends up in Boaz's field. Simultaneously, Boaz comes to his field to supervise his reaping operation. Take a look at it. So she departed, and she went and she gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come. You get that? She happened to come. You should circle that. There's no happened to come in the Bible. All right? that's a literary device to say God is at work. It's coincidence. That's God's fingerprint right there. She happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. Who's Boaz? Boaz is that family member that we've learned about. He's that guy that's noble. He's the wealthy guy that owns stuff. Boaz, it's his field that she happens to come into, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. Another coincidence. Look at that. Boaz just happens to be coming to his field to supervise it, to check out what's going on. And he said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." A common greeting between the master and his servants out in the field. And then Boaz says to his servant, verse 5, who's in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" Take a look at letter E. Boaz asks about Ruth, and he is informed by the foreman about her identity. The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." Clearly, her story is well known. People already know the reputation of Naomi and Ruth. They've already heard about the devastation that Naomi has experienced. But there's a footnote to the story, and you wouldn't believe it. One of her sons, her own daughter-in-law, her son got married to this girl named Ruth, and she had a choice to stay with her own family and chose to come back with Naomi and said that she would stay with her, she would die with her, that our gods would be her God. I mean, this woman is amazing and her reputation has preceded her. And she said, "Please let me glean." This is still the foreman reporting to Boaz. He's reporting that Ruth said, "Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves." Thus she came and has remained from morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while. The text indicates that Ruth's reputation as Naomi's Moabite has preceded her. There is a sliver of tension, though, that exists in the text. Right? I mean, Boaz, a Jew's Jew, is coming to his field and he sees someone gleaning in it. Now, the Levitical law commanded landowners to provide for those that were gleaning so that the destitute in Israelite society were taken care of. It was you'll remember that in Israelite society, it wasn't like because God was the king, God set up all of the social programs for the country. And this was one of the primary social programs for taking care of the poor. The landowners were not allowed to reap the very outside edges of their crops, so that the gleaners could come through and pick off of those. And anything that was dropped in the field had to remain in the field. You weren't allowed to set your stuff down, go and do some more work, and then come back and get your stuff. Anything that was left behind you was to be given to the poor. And so this was part of God's way of taking care of the poor that were in Israel. And so she has been gleaning in the midst of this, and Boaz identifies her and immediately finds out that she's a foreigner. Now, Boaz is not responsible to take care of her, even though she is an alien. A lot of landowners didn't. A lot of landowners rejected the alien. A lot of landowners rejected all gleaners. A lot of the workers would insult and abuse those that were gleaning in the fields. It was not a pleasant position to be in Israelite society. How is Boaz going to respond to her? What is he going to do with Ruth? Is Boaz going to tell her to kind of move on, to scoot along? It sure wouldn't be consistent with the nobility of character that was presented in verse 1. Boaz's response, in fact, is both noble and it is stunning. Take a look at it. We'll catch up with it in verse 8. But let me just preface it by saying, Boaz insists that Ruth remain in his fields to glean, among the maids or the wives of his workers, following along with his servants, enjoying the same rights which they receive. Look at it in verse 8. Then Boaz says to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter." Now, by the way, the fact that he addresses her as daughter right there would imply that he is just a little bit older than she is. He is probably age-wise closer to Naomi's age. He's closer in family to Elimelech and that kind of thing than he is necessarily to Naomi. So what we have is a little bit of an older guy. Now, you know, people got married a lot younger at this time period. Women got married at like 13, 14 years old and that kind of thing. So we would assume that Naomi, even if she was, you know, 10 years after she had been married and that kind of thing, we would assume that she's still in her early 20s. And we would also assume that because Boaz is an established landowner and he is established as being a man that is noble and has a good reputation in the community, that he is probably 10 to 15 years older than she is. So if she's in her mid-20s, that puts him just probably in his upper 30s and that kind of thing. So that's why he addresses her as daughter. He is almost kind of a protective figure as he's presented in this story. So that's just to give you a little bit of background on the story and that kind of thing. It was not unusual in Israelite society for a guy that was in his 30s or 40s to be married to a girl that was in her 20s, especially a widow. That was a normative part of that society. That is less a normative part of our society, although it's pretty normal. It's not unusual. There are lots of you in here that cradle robbed, and so that's what you're... Amen. Thanks. That was my brother-in-law right there. All right. We joke with him about that all the time. He graduated high school, and then she was born. All right. she's not in here right now, is she? Yep. Bummer for her. All right. No defending yourself. Boaz comes to her and says, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go on from this one." He's not telling her, "Stop your gleaning, you foreigner. Don't glean in another field and remain here. I want you to stay in this field. Stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you." He is providing protection for her. They are not to touch you. They are to treat you well. When you are thirsty, you go to the water jars and you drink from what the servants draw. You are to be treated well in my fields. And she falls on her face in verse 10, bows to the ground and says to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?" She is deeply grateful for what he has provided. She is overwhelmed. She is thankful. Letter G, top of the next page. And Boaz recounts to her that he knows her story. Look at it in verse 11. Boaz replies, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." Ruth was clear that she did not deserve what she was receiving. She fell on her face when she was given such an extraordinary gift. As Boaz is recounting this to her, you can imagine the overwhelmed feeling that must have been rushing over Ruth's entire body. He is simply extending the blessing of God to her for her compassionate devotion to Naomi. It is notable, letter H, that it is notable here that Boaz recognized that he was not the owner of his field. I just want you to see this clearly. The reason that God said to the landowners of Israel, you are to leave a portion of your field for the poor, you are to leave a portion of what you have, not only give the first portion of it to the Lord, but leave the last portion of it for the poor. Why does God have the right to ask that of his people? Because it's not their land anyway. It's not theirs. God provided it to them. God has given them life. He has given them country. He has given them land. He has provided everything for them. And the appropriate response to that is to do what the landowner asks of you. In this sense, Boaz is only a regent. A regent is an individual who governs while the king is away or while the king is absent. You and I have that same responsibility. You and I are given tremendous things in this world. Many of you own a house, or at least you're paying a bank for a house that they let you live in. Many of you have ownership of things. You own cars. You own stuff. You've got gigantic flat screen television sets, and you have been provided for in abundant ways. You and I, amen. I agree, Loy. I believe that in Southern California, it's one of the most difficult places to live in all of the United States. It's pretty difficult to live here. The cost of living is very, very high. These have been tough economic times, but do you know that by virtue of living here in Southern California, by virtue of the money that you make or the money that you enjoy, some of you live in your parents' homes and you just simply enjoy the wealth of your parents. You do not do anything to earn that wealth per se. You just get to live under their refuge, under their wings. That by virtue of that you are one of the wealthiest people in this country, and that this country is the wealthiest in the world, I know you don't feel that way. I sure don't feel that way. But the fact is, we could go on a missions trip to about 95% of the rest of the world, and we would find that they are poor and destitute comparatively, that you have many luxuries that they do not, that we enjoy some of life's greatest things right here in Southern California. And what is the response that we have to that? Oftentimes we have a tendency to hoard. Oftentimes we have a tendency to do more, more, more. Oftentimes our tendency is to see what next thing we can get. I want you to see a man with a proper perspective in Boaz. He recognized that his stuff didn't belong to him in the first place. He was a noble man. He clearly gave his tithe to the Lord. But more than that, he provided for the poor. He saw this woman who had left her country to come to his country and had honored Naomi in the process of that. And he says, don't go anywhere else. You gain all of your sustenance right here. I am making provision for you. I will take care of you. Those wings that you have sought for refuge, they're right here. You need look no further. We are called by God to participate as regents in the things that He owns. And He owns it all, my friends. He owns everything that you own. By virtue of us belonging to Him, by virtue of us being extended salvation by Him, He has purchased it all. And Boaz, as God's servant, extended compassion to Ruth. And it was a direct response to God's goodness for him. Don't miss this in the text. That godly men and women look at the things that they have, look at the families that they're in, look at all the stuff that they've got, and we recognize, hey, this is God's stuff. How can I use it for the glory of God? How can I use it to extend God's name in the midst of the stories that I find myself in the midst of your Ruth and Naomi. Both Ruth and Boaz, and this is critical, letter I. I can't believe I got that deep into one number. Letter I. Both Ruth and Boaz are shining examples of God's compassion. And in the Bible, in the Old Testament, it's called chesed. Chesed. You can spell it with an H if you want, but I just want to make sure you got that, like, you know, that Hebrew, you know, phlegmy sound going right at the beginning of it. Chesed, you know? That's how it's pronounced. Chesed. It's God's compassion. It's his loving kindness. It's his mercy. The parallel word in the New Testament is grace, charis in Greek. In the Old Testament, it's chesed. It's God's loving compassion, his mercy, his undeserved favor that he pours out on people. And Ruth and Boaz in this story are shining examples of God's chesed. And I wonder, as we make our way through this Christmas season, has the chesed of God taken control of your life? Has his loving kindness, his compassion, is it pouring out of you onto others? Into your families? Into this community? The theme of the book of Ruth is not redemption. It's not what God surprisingly can do. It's chesed. It's this simple idea of God's loving kindness, his loving mercy expressed through his servants. Chesed is never deserved. It can only be given. No one deserves the loving kindness of God. It's simply God's to give. But when God gives it, he does not expect you to hoard it. He does not expect you to hold on to it and just swim around in your pool of chesed. That's not God's point. God gives it to us to give away. And when we give it away, God gives us more. And when we give that away, God gives us more. Do you want to experience the fullness of God's loving kindness, his mercy, his grace in your life? Then start pouring it out on other people. There are so many opportunities to pour it out onto other people. Whether people make just flat out mistakes, whether people do things that are offensive to you, whether there are things that you have held in your life that are grudges against someone else, and it is time to let go of those things and extend chesed to those situations and to those people. Or maybe it's even just for you, where you feel like, God, I just don't measure up. I just want to give up. I'm done. I can't make it through another holiday season. This is killing me. I just don't measure up to who you are. Then perhaps the object of God's chesed is simply you. Accepting God's loving kindness. Receiving his grace. Accepting his mercy. See, Ruth knew she had nothing. And so when God's loving kindness was being poured out, does she go, nope, 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 don't deserve it. Born in sin, foreigner, can't take that. I'm going elsewhere. No, she does what is appropriate to do when God extends his loving kindness to a person. She accepts it. She takes it. She receives it. She humbles herself. And she falls flat on her face in appreciation. Is there a more appropriate response to God's grace than that? Is there a more appropriate position to be in front of God? I love it in Isaiah chapter 6 when the prophet comes into the throne room and he sees God seated on his throne. The train of his robe fills the temple with glory. And what does he do? Hey, I got a couple questions for you about some things that trouble me in this world. No. That's how we talk about it, isn't it? When I get to heaven, I got some things I got to talk to God about. I got some things I need to discuss with him. I'm a little ticked off about this, that, and the other. What does Isaiah do? He falls flat on his face. He falls flat on his face and he worships God. He is overwhelmed by who God is. We sing about the Savior coming to this earth. This morning we will remember what he did on our behalf at the cross. And I believe the attitude of our souls should be to fall on our faces, as Ruth did, and just say, what have I done to deserve this? You are so good to me. Extraordinarily, the story doesn't end there. I mean, this would be good enough, right? We could just chunk this thing off right there, and we would have a great story. Just clip it right at verse 13. I found favor in your sight. I'm so excited. You're treating me like one of your servants. This is great. At mealtime, verse 14, we got more to go. At mealtime, Boaz says to her, come here, that you may eat the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. Ooh. That doesn't make any sense to us, does it? Come here, dip your bread in my vinegar kind of thing. There's nothing more intimate in Jewish society than the opportunity to eat and break bread together. This idea, I'll just read it. Extraordinarily, Boaz invites Ruth to mealtime to eat with his own workers. And it says that he served her. Look at what he says. Come here. That you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain. And she ate and was satisfied and had some left. She was given so much that she had leftovers provided. He is providing for her abundantly. Boaz invites her to mealtime. He serves her, and she was satisfied. The scene gets more personal, more intimate. There is a spark in this moment in the story. There's something that goes beyond just chesed right here. Like, he had been nice enough, right? He had extended his loving kindness to her. But he invited her to a meal. He invited her kind of into the inner circle. And there's this spark right in this moment. The mixing of these two chesed characters in the story. So when she rose to glean, because they would eat in the afternoon so that there was more time to reap, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, even right where you are doing your harvesting. Well, I want her to be able to glean right there. Like, you give her the best of everything. Do not insult her. And you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it so that she may glean that. And do not rebuke her. Do not say anything mean to this woman. Do not rebuke her. Do not insult her. Do not touch her. Do you think he's been clear enough? You better treat her well. There's something that goes a little bit beyond just being nice here, isn't there? Can you feel the love tonight? Let her be. She rises to go back to her gleaning. Boaz tells his servants to make special provision for her, and he commands that she be protected, even to the point of not allowing her to be insulted. The fact is, the wings of God's refuge, from verse 12, which Ruth sought, are none other than the noble arms of Boaz himself. He is her provider. He is her protector. That is what we see here in this chapter. He is her provider and her protector. She has nothing. She is empty. She is devastated. She is a foreigner. She deserves nothing, and she should get nothing. And there would be nothing wrong with that. It would be just. And how does Boaz respond to that? He responds with God's loving kindness towards her. And he provides for her. And further, he protects her. He makes sure that she is protected. So she gleaned, verse 17, in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned. We'll talk about that another week. And it was about an epaph of barley, or a lot. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Like, she goes away with nothing, and she comes home literally with like a shopping cart full of grain, right? She's coming home, and she's been standing out, you know, this is how Naomi sees it. Yeah, go over to Ralph's and go ahead and ask people for food. And when she comes home, she's got a full shopping cart of groceries. So Naomi's a little overwhelmed. Naomi's like, man, you are some kind of gleaner, you know? She took it, she went to the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. So she was able to feed Naomi with the leftovers from the meal that she had eaten earlier in the day. And her mother-in-law says, where did you go to glean? Where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law, with whom she had worked and said, the name of the man with whom I worked today was, Boaz. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead. It's actually a little bit of a negative phrase. She cannot let go of the past. And she's gonna hold on to that. We're not going to see her let go of it till the very end of the story. And Naomi said to her, the man is our relative. In fact, he's one of our closest relatives. She calls him a kinsman redeemer. A kinsman redeemer. That's a phrase that we don't have in our vernacular or in our culture. And I'm going to explain what it means next week because I don't have enough time. And frankly, there wasn't enough space in my outline. It takes a little more. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest. Naomi said to Ruth, because this kind of raises Naomi's eyebrows, like, really? That's what he said to you, did he? She says to her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids so that others do not fall upon you in another field. In other words, you're protected there. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. That's a little hook at the end of the chapter. She's still living with her mother-in-law. You think that's going to change? I think it will too. What a phenomenal chapter in seeing Ruth go from a place of having nothing to being under the protection of a relative, not just a relative, but a close relative, a kinsman redeemer. The full significance of that will be teased out in the next chapter, which we're going to talk about next Sunday. But I cannot help but think as we come to our communion time this morning, that there are many of you right here, right today, right now, as we head into this Christmas season. You know, it can be very difficult, Thanksgiving to Christmas, for a lot of people. And I cannot help but think that many of you might be feeling that God is very distant, that He is far away, that He is not working in your life, that He is not doing anything. And this story of Ruth, I think, really shares with us that we should be living in the anticipation of what God will do. That even when we have failed miserably, even when we do not have any right to ask anything of God, God pours out His loving kindness and His mercy. He bestows it on us so lavishly, with just such a lack of concern for it costing Him. He just pours it out into the midst of our lives. And the ultimate, I mean, I cannot get away from the context of this. This was during the time of the judges when everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And the people were crying for a king. And yet God is their king. God is the one that wants to take care of them. God is the one that wants to govern them. God is the one that wants to be the influence in the midst of their lives. They cry out for the things that this world can offer to them. And God says, I want to be the one that is your protector and your provider. Look at what I can do. I'm going to tell you this little story about Ruth. I'm going to take a foreigner and I'm going to show you my loving kindness and my mercy. And God's going to let Israel walk through all the difficulty. He's going to let them walk through the kings and the monarchy and the divided kingdom in captivity. And He's going to bring them back from captivity. And then, when Israel's just literally devastated and has got nothing, God is going to provide His Messiah in Jesus Christ. And what's our response to that? Many of us have forgotten just how great God's grace truly is. So as we come to this table this morning, could I call on you to have that same response that Ruth did when she was given this lavish loving kindness of God? Would you fall on your face this morning in remembrance of Jesus Christ? Would you remember Him and thank Him for all that He has done? This is a commemoration of His body that is given for us on the cross. His body that took the place of yours on the cross. He replaced you. And for that we should be deeply, deeply grateful. His blood that he spilled is representative of grace, of chesed, of his covenant of love that he shares with us. It's representative of all that he has done for us, how little we deserve and how much he has given. And so as we eat and remember his body that was given for us, as we drink and remember his blood that was spilled for us, may we be encouraged to remember him in our daily lives. May we be drawn deeper into our relationship with him. The Apostle Paul gives us great instruction in 1 Corinthians for this. He said, "I received from the Lord, which I deliver to you, that the very night that Jesus was betrayed, he gave thanks. He took bread and he broke it and he said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' And in the same way, he took the cup after supper and he said, 'This cup is the new covenant of my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death.'" That's victory. The Lord's death, which secures victory over sin. It's the victory over death. We proclaim the Lord's death until he returns. "Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner shall be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. So a man must examine himself, and in so doing," after examining, in other words, "then we are to eat and then we are to drink." So this time comes with a little bit of caution that we are to inspect the interior of our lives, not according to our own judgment, but to take our lives in front of the Lord and say, "Lord, what do you see there? What do you see there, and what can I change so that I live my life in remembrance of you?" God knew that we would go through this life and it'd be too easy to just forget about him, to walk through life, not even think about God. So this is a time to readjust ourselves, to put our lives back on true north of the cross of Christ. That's why this is a time that is dedicated for those that have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now you might be sitting there this morning and you might realize, "I don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ. I've never accepted his loving kindness. I've never received his grace. I've never experienced his mercy." The Bible says that if you will come to Christ, if you will respond to God this morning, right now, if you will cry out to him, throw yourself down on your face, and thank God for what he has done on your behalf. If this is the attitude of your heart, it says that God will come and take residence inside of your soul, that he will take control of your life, and he will give you a new spirit. The Spirit of God will dwell inside of you as it does all that have received Jesus Christ as their personal Lord and Savior. And so I would call on you this morning to respond if you have never responded before. Receive the grace of God. Do not sit and just be a spectator in church. Engage the life that is Jesus. Set your life on the cross of Jesus Christ. His death is victory over sin, over death, and over all that comes along with it. Will you trust him with the whole of your life? If you do, then this communion is also for you. You are remembering what he has done on your behalf.